You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Receiving this message.
We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 872.1S0911, certificate number 25192, the Oracle of Delphi.
I have these memories from my life. None of them happened. What does that mean?
That the Matrix cannot tell you who you are.
But an Oracle can?
That's different.
How would you say you make decisions? Do you have, like, a process?
I don't.
That does not surprise me.
And I don't even know how to make decisions, because
every decision is like the first decision. You're like,
The thing is that the way that my brain handles information is it's just a massive flood of comparisons and contrasts. And I was thinking about this the other day, because a lot of people have said over the years, like, oh, well, in the event of some kind of uprising, you know, you'll end up being some weird general of some rebel faction. And the fact, I think, is that I would not be a good commander-in-chief. I think what I would be good at is to be a battlefield commander, in the sense that those decisions are fast, and you're
just reacting.
You're just reacting, and I'm extremely good at that. If you and I were suddenly in a crisis, I would be ready.
You'd
for
be
action.
Full of ideas,
and just like boom, boom, boom. But if you asked me to make a decision that requires any consideration, I will just compare and contrast every option, and that is not the way to do it.
So you do that, the pros and cons. And
just like, oh, but, you know, the result of this might be that, and this might be this.
Do you know I think this is right. Do you know the new research on this? That It turns out, like, we typically just make snap judgments very intuitively and then kind of back form a rationalization to explain to ourselves. So instead of taking factors A, B, and C into account, I've decided to go over here. We really, our brain is just like, I'm going to go over there. Let's see what would have been the reasons. Oh, yeah, A, B, and C, that's why.
And maybe the way my brain works is I do that prior.
Yeah.
And then get into the weeds. But I for sure, and I second guess.
I actually like not having options.
I do too.
If there's only one restaurant at the airport, beautiful. Because if there's two, I'm going to be like, poof, what am I feeling like?
Me too. Well, I like being lied to. too. I mean, a lot of people that have to deal with me, and I think you might, well, you know, we have our system worked out, but a lot of people will tell me that the thing actually starts a half an hour before it starts.
I guess I should do that.
And then I arrive 10 minutes late, but I'm actually 20 minutes early. And it's extremely effective.
Oh,
and
you like it?
I don't mind it at all.
You're the biggest fan of this system.
Well, one of the things I do is all the clocks in my house, I set each clock to a different time. So
on purpose?
Yeah.
How far off? What's the range here?
I mean, some of them are, they're all ahead of time, but some of them are five and some of them are, not five. Some of them are three, some of them are nine.
And this is to make, for 11. The same reason, to make you always early for things?
Well, yeah, just to confuse me about what the time is enough that I go, oh God, I must be late. No, I guess there are there any that are, I think maybe the one on the furnace is the actual time.
The one on the furnace?
Yeah, and then of course my phone, I figured out how to set the time 10 minutes early.
Your phone time is wrong?
Yes. But
this is new John lore.
The clock in my truck is connected to some truck clock.
Some cesium atoms that you can't fool.
Yeah, and I can't fool it. But the thing is, by the time I'm in my truck, I'm already on the way.
You could always just use painter's tape to cover up your correct truck clock.
I guess I could. But so anyway, all of that is part of not being a super effective manager of time and space. I think it was always true, this was even true when I was in school, that, I mean, I don't want to say something like dumb and pretentious, although the show is early, I'm going to say something dumb and pretentious.
Yeah, why stop now?
But I always feel like I want to say that I always saw in four dimensions because time was always visible to me. But I didn't because I was missing some other dimension. I think most people see time as a two-dimensional plane.
Well, you're saying you have length and depth and time, but no height or...
There was some other element that I was missing.
Time is the third dimension to you.
Although, no, I guess what it was I could see time as an orb, but the part that people saw as a linear
thing, like a timeline.
The timeline thing, I could not see. I couldn't see linear time. But I could, but I saw all time kind of at once.
This is why you're always late, because you're going to show up at some point on that four-dimensional.
That's right.
Hypersphere. You're still there. You're still there at some point in the future.
I'm not aware of appointments until the hour of the thing, right? Like I'll book shows and not remember it until the morning of the show. And it's like, you need to have prepared for this.
But I mean, artistic decisions are a kind of decision. Like, are you with a set list? Or are you like,
Well, this is a lot of our tours, I would start the show with no set list and just yell out to the crowd, what do you want to hear next? And we could play a 3-hour show just taking suggestions from the first 10 rows of people, because those were the voices I could hear.
Also, those are maybe the people that have requests. There were casual fans that got there too late to get a good spot. They're like, we don't know who you are. We're here for the drinks.
There are none of those. Every single person lined up front is like, I won the lottery. But no, a lot of the reason my records sound different from one another is that in the studio, I'm very susceptible to someone with a strong opinion. So if I'm like, oh, well, I could put an organ on this, or I could actually just put a...
I should be using this more.
Nothing on this. If there's somebody there that's like, this needs to be a flanged bass, I'm like, a flanged bass? And so my songs and my records are very influenced by the people that work on them.
I just realized I have a hard time even booking flights because I'm like, oh boy, there's six options.
Me too. I can't do it.
Am I going to want to get there earlier? Am I going to be mad at myself that I had to leave the house so early? What if I need the points on Delta more than Alaska? So there have been times in my life where I have made like the pros and cons list, but even at the time I was doing it, I was like, this is not actually going to make a decision for me.
So wait, you have the same problem? Well, does Mindy make your decisions? I bet she does.
I feel like there's a lot of like, let's do the thing where you narrow it down and then I'll pick one. So somebody narrows it down from infinity to three restaurants.
Right.
And then I'll go from three to one.
Yeah.
Or there will be a system like, you know, instead of choosing a movie, let's just watch whatever's next in whatever we're watching, you know?
I for sure think that people pitch stuff at me as a binary. And then if they say, okay, we're doing this, and I go, then they realize that I actually prefer the other.
Yeah, yeah. I think I'm sometimes that guy. Yeah. I don't care, Mindy. She's like, okay, well, we'll go to the Thai place. You know, now that you say it.
Geez, I don't want to.
But even when I was making the pros and cons list, I was like, this is basically divination. Like, I'm not actually going to, this is not an equation that will like carry the one. Oh, it looks like I should major in this. Like, it's just a construct that I'm putting in front of me. It might as well be the I Ching. You know, I'm making a list, but it's an exercise, not an actual algorithm, you know? And I guess it's not that much different than the ancient Greeks doing divination with the flight of birds or what the entrails, they're into entrails, right?
Yeah.
Of all why entrails, of all the objects that surround you, why are entrails the ones that tell you the future?
Well, they're so random looking when you cut open a bird, like it really is a thing that spills out.
You just want complexity?
It just seems like it's going to spell something. It's
tea leaves, but grosser.
Yeah, right.
Maybe that's why we switched to tea leaves.
I mean, I just read a quote from some famous American. Oh, you know who it was? It was Charles Fort.
Oh, wow.
Of the 14 times.
How have we not done 14 times on the Omnibus?
Definitely going to do it.
Should we switch to Charles Fort right now?
No, I think I need a little time to research him. But Charles Fort said that in his experience, people who were resolutely against anything that wasn't science were really no different from people who were resolutely against science in terms of
I kind of buy that.
How much they were unconsciously biased, and that unconscious bias essentially like randomized their decision making.
Certainly, you will see, you know, people who are rationalists who are just as dogmatic
right.
as anybody with a spiritual setup viewpoint for their
lives. That dogmatism has more effect on how they read the science than the difference between science and superstition.
The Greeks in particular believed that knowledge about decisions could come from anywhere. You know, if you sneezed at a certain time, if the lightning flashed in a certain pattern, that the world was full of not portents of the future so much, but information that could tell you more about your life and how to live. You know, this would be, to them, it would be Vox Dei. It would be like, this was the voice of God as revealed through bird entrails.
Which isn't that different in principle from all the expressions of the voice of God, right? That aren't explicitly like God speaking to you from a bush.
Exactly. If you're just a modern Christian saying, oh, well, I'll pray on that. Right. And then you just kind of sit and think, you know, it's just a set of, you know, you're kind of ordering your thinking the same way somebody else might do it with a list of pros and cons or whatever else they feel their heuristic is.
But especially like the branch of sort of evangelical Christianity that sees hurricanes as God's retribution for people in Florida discos or...
I guess they're not looking for information. They just want validation.
I guess that's right.
And when the hurricane comes to me, well, that's because Joe Biden can control the weather. That's the other kind of hurricane.
Right.
The good ones are only, you know, beating up on the liberals and the gays. When they hit Asheville, well, I mean, not Asheville, but surrounding.
Asheville full of gays and liberals.
Exactly. But, yeah. You know, 20 miles outside of Nashville.
Right. No. Those are the good people.
Yeah, that's a Biden hurricane.
Somebody was asking me just the other day if in my travels I... had a lot of exposure to the evil eye. And
that's true. You went through Balkan and Mediterranean ports.
Yeah, a lot of places. And Morocco and, you know, Greece. And I did have a lot of exposure to the evil eye, and it really made me... The more I looked into, like, the kind of thinking around the evil eye, it just felt like a very dangerous thing to say was part, you know, was like...
Because it justifies violence for a mean look?
And also...
Or an imagined mean look?
Yeah, your teenage daughter gets the evil eye from somebody and she's cursed and will never be married. Like, all that stuff. And I mean, I'm sure that's true of everything, but...
You think it's true of that people can get cursed by the evil eye?
No, but that they're, again, the kind of conscious bias or the I'm not sure what the equivalent is for me, because I don't really think of luck as playing any role or chance.
Oh, really? You control your destiny?
No, not that either. But just I don't think of it as, because that idea that luck or chance is actually controlled.
It's a force, I see.
Rather than just like,
coincidence.
I turned left instead of right, and the rest of my life I'll have to live with that.
I guess it just occurred to me how much of modern day woo is decision making. You know, like, I need a framework, and I'm a Sagittarius. Let me check this out.
Yeah,
or right. I need a framework, and which color crystal is it? Or I don't want to reduce these things, but it's kind of
go for it.
But these morons. No.
But like,
but it's kind of the same thing. It's just
manifesting.
Like, I need a framework.
Yeah,
right. Because life's tricky, and I'm going to have to decide things, and it's obviously going to be unknowable, and the stakes are high. Like, just having I have an 18-year-old, and we're trying to decide on a college based on the vibes of a 90-minute tour, you know. Yeah. And you realize, modern decision making is still stupid, you know, like. The world is not set up for people to actually make good, informed decisions.
What's funny is that modernity is kind of, the whole premise of it is we're going to systematize decision-making.
Decisions will be better.
Yeah, we're going to make it based on the evidence.
And it's because we have all this new information. But in fact, the multiplicity of information makes the decisions harder.
And it's processing evidence that's the hard part. That's the thing about, you were saying last episode about about political polling.
Oh, yeah.
It's like political polling is...
I think that was 2 weeks ago.
Political polling is great if you don't, you know, just fill that space with conflicting polls.
If nobody's, you know, using the polling data in real time,
right. Then
it's perfect. But of all these methods that the Greeks in particular had to say that God would speak to us, they believed in the burning bush as well. Like, they thought there, if you made enough effort, you could get more direct, personalized information that would be even more specific than, I sneezed twice at in the afternoon today. You know what that means.
It was gods, plural, right? They were, any of the gods could send you a weird sign.
Multiple gods had, you know, they all had different ways of communicating. They all had different cults. And Apollo was very important because, along with all his other portfolios, you know, he's a sun god, but he's also the poetry god and music. But in particular, he's the god of inspiration. Which is kind of funny, because it seems like the god's bailiwick should be like areas of the natural world, but his is more like an org chart thing, you know? I guess that's true of Hermes as well. Hermes is logistics. He's the messenger.
Right.
Apollo is the god in charge of inspiration, so his cults and priests should have the best advice for you.
But any artist will say, I have no idea where this artwork came from, and... You know, a lot of contemporary songwriters, myself included, kind of sit down at the piano, write a whole song in an hour, and go, without crediting the divine, I have no way of explaining why my best song took me 40 minutes to write.
You can see why so many composers were like, I will glorify God with my sonatas.
And painters and, you know, like,
where else would it come from?
Why? And that is maybe for secular artists the most convincing evidence of the supernatural. Although it never feels like, you know, when you're sitting there, right. It never feels like, you're just like, that's a good idea.
It's not coming
that's
from
a good idea.
Yeah. It seems to be coming from within yourself.
But it might be Apollo.
Maybe it's Apollo.
Yeah.
So his jurisdiction over inspiration meant that, you know, all the gods had temples.
Right.
But Apollo had one particular temple. At Delphi, the slopes of Mount Parnassus. This is...
Which was the name of the really great cafe in the basement of the art building at the University of Washington.
Is it still there?
No.
It's not?
They shut it down.
Oh, man. Today, that's just, I don't know, a few hours northwest of Athens, I think. But back in the day, you know, Greece being mountainous, it was not easy to get there. It would take a considerable journey and sacrifice. Maybe you'd want to even take a sailing voyage. You go all the way around the Peloponnesus and come up through the Gulf of Corinth.
That seems like a long trip.
But the trip was important. The trip was part of the pilgrimage you would make to get wisdom from the oracle at Delphi. You know, we have stories of the oracle of Delphi going back to Hesiod. You know, it's about as old as it gets as far as surviving tales. And that's like 8th century BC. So the oracle certainly existed nearly at least, you know, 1,000 years before Christ. And, or BCE, I can't remember which we landed on.
I think you just say BC anymore.
And it turns out that most of the accounts we have are from like 1,000 years later. You know, most of the accounts that survive of what was actually going on at Delphi are from like Roman times, 200 years later.
These are stories about stories.
Yeah, but except that the oracle is still running. The oracle lasts for centuries.
Oh, okay.
Nothing shuts down the oracle. It's like a Waffle House, basically. But we're hearing stories of stories, and we're hearing literary versions of what really went on there. So, you know, there's a lot of supposition about who was going to Delphi and why. In the 8th century, it seems like a lot of the advice being sought there.
8th century BC?
Yeah. So almost 3,000 years ago, a lot of the advice being sought is like, it's advice of state, you know, hey, we're the Lydians. We want a new colony. Where should that be? So if you're already on a voyage, you would add Delphi to that voyage and let that pick your destination. So instead of leaving with a road atlas, it's like, hey, we're going to stop at the first gas station and get one of those maps and that's where we'll go. And there were lots of stories about why this particular spot, why Apollo would have a shrine here.
It really is in what we think of as the Greece that is it's not Macedon, it's real southern
it's
Greece.
It's not far from Athens.
Yeah, right. As the crow flies.
Today it's a day trip. You know, if you want to see Delphi, it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. There's some monasteries on the way. Yeah, rent a car and you'll be back in Athens for dinner. But this particular location was important to the Greeks. They called it the omphalos, the belly button of the world.
Whoa.
They thought Delphi was not just where you would get inspiration, but there was something geometrically, geographically magical and central about it. In one myth, Zeus releases an eagle from each end of the earth. And I guess now that I think about it, he'd have to have a confederate to do this, or?
Well, no, he's Zeus. He could
teleport?
Well, or he could just, his arms, he could stretch out his arms like Stretch Armstrong. And
he's a big guy.
Yeah. Or, you know, he's got all those lesser gods that are always trying to appeal to his.
He could wrangle nature. An assistant.
Yeah. Hey, you, head over there. Or I'm going to turn you into a white rock.
Yeah. That's what he's always doing. I'm just going to say it, John. I am now in my 50s.
Yes,
and
you are.
My hair is not quite as thick as it was when I was not in my 50s.
Yeah, but you know, you've been taking the cure, whereas I struggle to do anything, frankly. And I feel like my hair is thin. My daughter laughed at me the other day.
It's just a normal thing that guys don't talk about, but like everybody's hair gets thinner. It's just part of aging. But as I learned, if you've lost your hair, it doesn't mean you can't find it again.
That makes me feel great because I want it back.
Hims is a hair loss solutions company with hundreds of thousands of subscribers that they have helped.
That's Hims, H-I-M-S.
Right.
Yeah.
Because they'll give you convenient access to FDA-approved hair loss treatments, all from the comfort of your couch. Clinically proven ingredients like finasteride, minoxidil. In a matter of months, you can see a difference.
But now, I was given some stuff that was like a foam you take, but then there was also pills. Like, I don't understand. Is it all these different things, or what if I don't like one of the shampoos or something?
That's the great thing about Hims. It's all online, so there's no doctor's visits. You can try chewable stuff, oral spray, serum, you know, figure out what works best for you. One low price covers everything from treatments to ongoing care.
So what do I do to start my free online visit at hims.com/omnibus?
If I were you, I would go to hims.com, hims.com/omnibus, to find out what your personalized hair loss treatment options are.
So hims.com/omnibus?
Correct. Results vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription products require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information. So either alone or with an assistant, he releases an eagle from both ends of the earth. They fly toward each other, and they cross over each other right over Mount Parnassus. That's how you know it's the belly button of the Earth.
Where do they think they're going? To the other side?
To the other end, yeah. And I guess you could do it again. You could keep repeating it to make sure you had the right belly button. And this was foundational enough to the Delphi myth that there was actually a big kind of egg-shaped marble thing there that they thought they referred to as the Omphalos. This is the stone that is the Earth's belly button.
Wow.
And that was where the site of the Mantic, you know, the Delphic Oracle would be.
Currently in the British Museum.
There actually is a museum at Delphi that has a replica of it from Roman times that's kind of intricately carved and apparently an attempt to recapture the one. Because, you know, a thousand years go by and the thing's still running.
Right.
So it would be like me explaining the Magna Carta.
Right. Which kind of is still running in a weird way.
Well, I guess that's what this podcast is. Yeah. Like me giving very approximate descriptions of old things I don't really know about. And that's what it would be. There are other stories about why, in particular, Apollo there. The oracle there, the woman that was sought for counsel was called the Pythia. And that's from one of Apollo's epithets. You know, the Greek gods had, in addition to their main name, they would have a little nickname because they would have various roles, I guess, in the same way, you know, maybe not too different from
you and I, who have separate roles.
Well, I guess I was thinking about how you would say, like, God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Ghost. You know, you would say Zeus the Thunderer, but there's also Zeus the Creator and
Zeus the Merciful.
Zeus who makes the flowers to grow. In this case, Apollo was sometimes called Apollo Pytho because he killed a scary dragon called Python, which is where we get the name of our snake, at this site.
Oh.
So Apollo founded a temple after shooing the dragon that was making trouble on the slopes of Mount Parnassus.
Is there any sense of who really founded the temple? I'm not an Apollo doubter, but
apparently you are, since I tell you two cool stories and you're like, yeah, you got anything without dragons and eagles? There is a more naturalistic story. A goatherd, whom Plutarch actually gives a name, Corellus the goatherd, is tending his flock on the slopes of Mount Parnassus. And some of his goats wander into a chasm, and he notices that when they breathe the strange fumes of this chasm, the goats start to bleat strangely.
Oh.
Because Plutarch, writing in, I think, the 2nd century AD, is actually a priest at the Temple of Delphi. And so he's aware of what the daily logistics were, at least 1,000 years into its term. And he knows that the oracle, the Pythia, does breathe in some kind of fumes from the earth.
Are you sure the it's not just goat language for get us out of this chasm?
Presumably he's heard that bleat before.
I see, sure.
And now he's like, boy, this fume bleat is a different bleat.
The old fume bleat. This is apes taking mushrooms.
Basically, stoned goat theory might be what you would call it. Pausanias, writing around the same time, I think 2nd century AD, says that there's a whole history of different temples on this site. Like the first one is a temple in the shape of a hut, but it's made of just laurel branches, a primitive temple. Then the second one, I don't know what to credit this to, the second temple was actually built by bees. So it's made of honey and bird feathers. I mean, I guess you can see why the bees would use honey. It's not unclear.
How does a bee carry a bird feather?
The birds and the bees. Why?
I guess flowers in the trees.
But yeah, honey, I can't think of a worse building material.
Well, they're good at building, but it's the comb rather than the honey.
Right, it would be very sticky if you actually tried to build a temple out of honey, I would assume.
This is a thing that's never occurred to me. Do birds ever go to bees' nests? We don't call them nests. Beehives? And eat honey? It does seem very birds love sugar water.
Hummingbirds do. Yeah, I guess.
Do hummingbirds ever brave the bees to, what would happen? Does a bee want to sting a hummingbird?
I'm going to say a bee would sting anyone.
There are ornithologists and ichthyologists that are screaming at their headphones right now.
I think it's just mammals. It's just a sleepy bear. A sleepy bear is the only thing that wants to get into a beehive. And the bees are like, bzzz, no, bzzz. After the honey temple presumably washes away in the first rain.
Ichthyologists are the scientists of fish.
Correct.
I'm not sure what I was. Now there were other scientists.
You said ornithologists. You were right.
But there were also ichthyologists listening who were like,
the entomologists.
Screw you.
The entomologists would be the bees.
The etymologists are the ones that are really hating all
this. Yeah. The third temple after the honey washes away, there's a temple of bronze, which in their lore didn't survive. It was either melted by a fire or swallowed up by the earth. Hmm. And then finally, Pausanias says, then there's the stone temple done by these famous architects that we see today. So it was like, you know, he...
And then the stone temple pilots.
Yeah, the stone temple pilots lived there.
Who drove it.
They're elegant bastards. So we have all these kind of famous stories of people seeking guidance from the oracle, from mm-hmm. Apollo's chosen servants at his oracle at Delphi, and big names. You know, Midas goes there, and Gyges, King Croesus, the rich King Croesus of Lydia goes there.
Top men,
richer than Croesus. Croesus was famously skeptical. He was like, well, there's all these seers and priests out there. How do I know they're giving me the real deal? Which is a question we still ask today, I think.
Yeah, right. How do I know that my Sagittarius rising is...
Exactly. So he devised a test. He used an early experiment. He sent messengers to dozens, I think, of different oracles and asked them all, what is King Croesus going to be doing on a certain date?
Oh, come on. That's pretty cheaty, but okay.
Well, today, you know, you would say, well, you can't tempt God with that, but I don't know what the Apollo's objection would be. I guess it shows your lack of faith, I guess.
But he's asked, because they're not all oracles of Apollo, right? He's going to oracles of
various gods
and seeing like who's got the insight.
Who's the best god? And the oracle from Delphi is the one that came back with a very specific, but it turns out accurate answer. On this date, Croesus will be boiling a lamb and a tortoise in a bronze cauldron.
But presumably, Croesus didn't just do it.
Well, presumably the messengers arrive right as he's in the middle of his lamb and tortoise boiling, and they're like, here's your message, sir. And he opens the raven. He's like,
whoa!
And maybe he chose to do the weirdest thing possible, thinking no one will predict if I do something so random, like boiling a lamb and a tortoise in a bronze cauldron.
So who are the people giving the answer? I mean, I could see where if it was just like a pond and you flipped a green stone in there for a yes or no answer, but he's asking real people.
Yes, you're getting, and we have in fact, at least accounts of maybe 500 or 600 different excerpts as if fortune cookie fortunes, you know, word for word text that came down from the Oracle of Delphi. Well, let's skip ahead to what that,
Were they crones? Were they crones in robes sitting behind a screen?
It is a woman, and there is a screen.
Yeah.
It's interesting that it's a woman, right? Because it's a very male-dominated society, and Apollo is a male god.
Right.
You know, traditionally, a priestess, you know, the Vestal Virgins would represent a female goddess. This is unusual because a woman is speaking for a male god.
But women are wiser in this world, in this way, even now. I would ask a woman faster than a man.
Almost
if
any
I had
question.
Really any question, yeah. Because the guy's going to be like, I don't know, which one's radder?
Is that always the second?
I mean, it's most of the guys I know.
If you go to the dude Oracle of Delphi, like, he always just says, whichever one's radder.
Whichever one's radder, man, like, which one gets the biggest air?
I guess there's this thinking that primitive cultures were often, the reason why women were oppressed is because the men were afraid of their life-creating power.
Still?
Yeah. Like, you know.
I live in terror.
Everything, basically everything I could do, a woman could do, but I cannot do the main thing a woman can do, which is like create and feed new life.
Right.
The main thing we need, the only reason I exist, and it's the province of women, and I am not cool with that.
Well, also,
and that
you
leads
know,
to patriarchy.
I mean, it's like, yeah, they're scared of the creating life, but also like, ugh, they can be so mean.
The Oracle was sometimes mean. Like, just to finish the story of Croesus, after ascertaining that this was the best Oracle, he goes and says, hey, should my country of Lydia invade Persia? Should I go to war with Persia? And the Oracle says, if you go to war with Persia, it will destroy a great empire. Now, you and I attuned to centuries of fairy tales. I think we can see the gotcha here.
We sure can.
But Croesus is like, it will? Oh boy, that's exactly what I wanted to do. Destroy the great empire of Persia. I have no follow-up questions.
I mean, I guess you and I have both heard this story already, so we know how it turns out.
Some version of this story.
Yeah.
I feel like the canny modern audience on binge-watching this on a device on a show, even if they had never heard this before, they would be like, I know what's gonna happen.
This is like asking the genie for eternal life.
But a lot of these requests did come from embassies of state, like, you know, important personages would come, like Lycurgus is running Sparta, and he wants to know, he wants advice from the oracle. And consulting the oracle, Herodotus says he is told, Lycurgus, here you are. You have come to my rich temple, beloved of Zeus and all who dwell on Olympus. Should I address you in my prophecy as a god or as a man? I think it would be better to call you a god, Lycurgus.
Oh.
And this is exactly the kind of motivational thought he needs to just remake Sparta in his own militaristic image and makes it into the most powerful city-state of his time. Mm-hmm. And it's all because he got a great motivational message from the Pythia. On the other hand, Solon of Athens is told, position yourself now amidships, for you are the pilot of Athens. Grasp the helm tight in your hands. You have many allies in your city. And he again thinks, oh, I'm going to be a great reformer. But he does the opposite thing. He democratizes Athens, having been told by the Pythia that he will re-steer Athens on a new course.
Mm-hmm.
Croesus, unsuccessful. Oh, there's a famous one where I think it's the Athenians are thinking of invading King Xerxes' Persia. And they're told specifics. They're told, far-seeing Zeus gives you a wall of wood. Only this will stand intact and help you and your children. And so they have to interpret even though it's a specific text, they're like, what's a wall of wood?
I'm struggling to interpret that.
Well, if you were told, if you wanted to invade Persia and you were told a wall of wood, what are your ideas here?
Well, it's a big forest that is hard to get through with your army.
Could be a forest.
Could be an actual, wall made out of wood.
This was the debate. When the delegation came home, everybody on the Acropolis is like, well, are we supposed to build a big stockade? It turned out to not be the answer. Mm. Others interpreted a wall of wood as being wooden ships.
Oh, on the water.
Right. That's not the clearest.
Both free and easy.
Free and easy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not the clearest interpretation of a wall of wood.
Right.
But that turns out to be the correct one, or at least the one that happens. So the Athenians they do send an armada. They are victorious at Salamis. And in hindsight, they're able to say, the wise oracle who told us a wall of wood, clearly
the
masts of ships.
Hindsight, though.
Yeah, if the oracle is vague enough, it covers all outcomes.
That'd be the great thing about being an oracle is just like throwing out the craziest, like, an egg of stone awaits you on the,
Alexander the Great was not having any of this. In the story, he drags the unseen oracle out by her hair.
Oh.
And says, like, tell me if I'm going to conquer the world. And she, with her, you know, aching scalp, says, boy, you are invincible.
Hmm.
And was right.
For a while.
I guess everyone's invincible given a short enough time frame.
That's right.
He did better than most.
I feel invincible right now.
Just had a coffee.
But Alexander the Great died when he was 35, right?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
But he was the oldest person in the world at the time. They're like, 35? Easy there, Grandpa. So all these stories were kind of handed down. And as a result, I think we think this is kind of the average Oracle of Delphi experience, like a ruler needs the future predicted about a military campaign. And in fact, I think these are just the ones that became literary. This is not really the day-to-day of the Oracle of Delphi.
Like, was it really people just lining up like, my daughter likes this guy?
There were heads of families just lining up for family advice, you know, athletes and poets and, you know, all walks of life appeared. And people came from all over the Mediterranean. It was the belly button of the world, they called it.
Surely they had to throw a ducat in a bucket.
Yes, it was not free. So here's the actual experience of what it was like. I mean, the main difference is that in these stories, people are all seeking prophecy. In fact, that was not the vibe. It wasn't like, tell me the future. It was really like, I need some advice. You know, it was like, describe my situation to me. And
So it was just people like me who were like, hey, can you just talk about me to me for a while? Like,
it was like a podcast, basically. It would kind of be like somebody in hundreds of years, the only thing they know about carnival games is like from the movie Big, you know, like, so they think,
right.
They think carnival it's games grant wishes. Yeah. Like Zoltar does. Whereas, so we just have the stories about the time that the Oracle of Delphi, just kind of this regular part of the pattern of Greek life actually, you know, something kind of big and mythical scale happened there, but that's not typical.
I do know that the ancient Greek, currency was the drachma, not the ducat.
Not the ducat, but it doesn't rhyme with bucket.
Right. It would be the drachma in the bachma.
Put some, there's got to be something better. Put some drachma in your
pocketma.
There were plenty of attendants there. There were priests who would queue people up.
Mm-hmm.
And they would queue them just kind of nakedly by status. Like if you were very important, if you were here from the city state of whatever, you would get to go first. And then, you know, behind you, military, and behind you, you know, a famous athlete might get to go ahead of an artist or a poet or a playwright, and then...
So not really compatible with Marxism.
Not at all. The opposite of compatible with Marxism. And they wouldn't give advice very often.
Oh.
I think the Oracle only operated on the seventh day after a new moon.
Oh, I thought you meant... that people would line up all day and like 8 out of 10 times they'd be like, nah.
I don't got anything. Nothing's coming through. Next.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring, Indeed, is all you need.
Well, it would kind of be that way. Most days they wouldn't prophesy. It would be like once a month, only 9 months out of the year, on the seventh day after the new moon. And even then, everything had to go right. Like they would sacrifice, let's see, what would they do? There was a goat. You would pour holy water from the spring onto the goat. And then if it shivered in a certain way, you'd be like, oh, this is a good prophecy day. You'd sacrifice the goat to the gods and then get on with it. Then the priestess would like ascend her tripod. This is, I bet you didn't guess that there was going to be a tripod in this story.
I didn't. Is this War of the Worlds?
It's the City of Golden Lead. There was a kind of a platform on legs above the chasm, the famous chasm from which the fumes came.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. And so she would install herself there.
She would climb up the tripod over the chasm.
But also this is somehow happening in like the Aditon, which I think is just Greek for like no trespassing. It was like a place no one could go to.
Oh, so they didn't all crowd around and watch her.
Yeah, there's some inner sanctum where, you know, you're led in by the attendants. Mm-hmm. You have to pass all these bronze statues, there's treasure houses, there's marble, you know, because Delphi gets a pretty good income from all the petitioners bringing their ducat in a bucket.
Right.
And you pass by, there's a cryptic letter E up on the wall.
That nobody knows what it is?
Even the classical writers are like, boy, there's a lot of theories about why there's a letter E up on the wall.
Hmm.
Nobody knows.
Epsilon.
Taking the letter, yeah, I guess maybe not an E, but a... I guess eta is H. It's an epsilon? Yeah, it's epsilon, right? Taking the letter epsilon from their Vosity sweater. And then you pass by three, when you get to the top of the hill, there's a colonnade of pillars, and there's three big slogans, proverbs up on the wall. And in the Delphi myth, these were all kind of famous pronouncements of the oracle. But I think modern scholars are more likely to say, oh, these were just proverbs that got put up on the wall and then they got reverse engineered into, as the oracle famously said.
They didn't change them out. They were up there. They were the three.
It wasn't like a church marquee that was like,
right,
with a funny thing of the day. It always said three things. It said, know thyself, nothing in excess, and then possibly more confusingly, give a pledge and trouble is at hand. That last one's, you know, give a pledge and trouble is at hand. Even people at the time weren't sure what that meant.
These just sound like Instagram aphorisms.
I mean, know thyself.
But give a pledge, doesn't that just mean throw some money in a bucket? Some ducat in a bucket?
I think it means actually giving a pledge is bad. Like if you give a pledge, trouble is at hand. And there was some discussion about whether that meant like, don't pledge your own property as collateral on a loan. Like it's kind of a financial advice, or is it romantic advice? Like don't pledge your troth to your crush.
It sounds a little bit like don't make any promises.
Yeah, it could just be that. Like don't make big sweeping statements at all. Know thyself is the one that kind of sounds like a self-affirmation today.
Right.
And that was Plato's take on it. You know, Plato said, actually, know thyself means, you know, you should have self-understanding. You should spend a lot of time considering your own soul. And
right. But we hear that, know thyself. Isn't that a motto that's carved into the Supreme Court or some? I mean, it does feel like a thing that's contemporary and...
But before Plato, in fact, people took know thyself to mean like, don't put on airs. Like, no, like you're not a god. You're not the king.
You're just Joe.
You're just you. So like, know thy place in the universe and maybe keep your head down.
Right.
So they're not really they're not as empowering as we would think today.
Right. That was an era where there were probably fewer security guards. So much more like get inside people's heads.
And then with those proverbs in mind, you would, when it was your turn, step up to the oracle. And, you know, as I think I said, Plutarch is very aware of, you know, the oracle herself has been purified. She's, you know, she's bathed naked in the Castalian spring.
But didn't shiver. Otherwise, she would have been thrown into the chasm.
I think shivering is good, but maybe only for a goat. It's a very complicated belief system. And that's when you could ask your thing. And you would never see the priestess, who's, again, in this hidden inner sanctum. And in some eras, it seems like the priest would have to interpret her words.
Yes.
So she might just be, isn't this how...
Still
it,
true.
Isn't this how it'd be? Uh-huh. Like, so maybe she would just kind of babble, and they'd be like, oh, what a blessing from the gods. The oracle has said, and then they give you the little slip of paper.
It happens all the time where it's like, here's what your mom really means.
Please exit through the gift shop. But in other cases, it does seem like the oracle is very aware of, you know, it is actually speaking the words. And so even at the, you know, Plutarch spends a lot of time thinking about, well, what does that mean? Like, how are the gods even, how does the system even work? I believe in the gods, but how am we to understand this oracle? You know, like if she's just breathing in fumes, then
she's just tripping.
Yeah. Is this just coming from the fumes? Because the ancients knew about volcanoes and stuff.
Right. Presumably knew about getting high.
And I guess their answer to that was, well, the gods are also in the earth, you know? Like, the fumes that are coming out of the earth to inspire her are also the will of Apollo.
Right.
So it all works out. And...
Don't look too deeply in it.
Exactly. And in fact, there has been, you know, I think for centuries, you know, even in classical times, there was some discussion of how the oracle might actually work.
Mm-hmm.
Today, like my friend, I was talking to my friend who had been to Delphi, and he's like, yeah, you know, the deal with Delphi is this is where people would come from all over the Mediterranean to ask questions about their own affairs, about geopolitics. And the priest would spend some time talking to the people about their questions.
Oh.
So it might be not too different from a modern day psychic doing a cold read.
Right.
You know,
right.
The priests have actually prepared. But more than that, this would be the one place in the ancient world that had all this knowledge coming from all over. People would speak honestly about military plans, about political machinations, about social issues.
So they actually would have a lot of wisdom.
Yes.
And, yeah.
Like this basically was the information center of the classical world. And so the Oracle of Delphi is basically a big data solution. You know, right. It's taking in all these ideas and it can do generative AI and just tell you what text you would hear next, given all the stuff that it has been fed in.
I wonder how many times both sides of an argument or a situation consulted the Oracle, and when the second person came, they already knew like the whole standpoint of the first person, and they could say like, "Well, here." Well, that's our insight.
Yeah, if the Persians have already been there being like, hey, are the Athenians going to attack? Right. Then you've got a lot more power if you're the Pythia. I asked I was like, that's fascinating, Dave. Like, do you know what historian that draws from? And he was like, I don't know. Like, I went to Delphi and the woman told me this. And I was like, the oracle?
What?
Like,
there's still an oracle?
He was like, no, the tour guide. But, you know, it was wisdom I got from Delphi, I guess. So
why has nobody set up a tent and started, you know,
giving out fortunes today?
Yeah, like rolling their eyes back in their head and being like, the Apollo says this.
Cross my palm with euros. Despite Plutarch's very specific descriptions of fumes coming out of a chasm and prompting the mantic trance of the oracle, it was well understood pretty much for all of modernity that was impossible. That there is no volcanic activity in the area of Delphi. That these are all just exaggerations. There is no chasm. There is no fissure. There are no fumes. These are all just exaggerations.
It wasn't just helium escaping the earth?
Do not attack Persia. This state of affairs lasted until 1996.
What did? That nobody thought there were any fumes?
Nobody understanding how the Oracle of Delphi might have worked beyond just the same way a fortune cookie works. In the 1980s, there was a UN surveyor in the area named Gel Zeiling de Boer. I'm going to guess he's Dutch.
Mm-hmm.
And while doing some surveying work again for the UN in the region, he spots in a different part of the region, a different part of Mount Parnassus, he spots an exposed fault. And then crossing over to the west side of Delphi, he sees the same fault continuing.
Oh.
And he suddenly realizes, I don't think anyone notices this, but there's a fault going right under Delphi. And then he later finds some other fault that would have intersected it.
It's the intersection of two faults?
So in 1995, he's chatting with this the American archaeologist named John Hale. He's like, oh, I was actually doing some work for the UN in that region. There actually is a fault running over there. And John Hale's like, nope. No, there's not. This has been well understood for centuries. That's all ancient myth. And he's like, no, I've seen it. It's exposed several miles east and west. And John Hale immediately thinks, if this is true, this is a big deal.
Yeah.
Like, this would reshape our thinking on this. So in conjunction with this surveyor, this archaeologist, they are like, we need to get a team together. They find a chemist. They find a toxicologist. They go to Delphi and do a survey. And I think this is when they find there is actually another fault running perpendicular that intersects this fault right, right near where the temple complex is today. Because there's still ruins today.
Is that 15 feet, 1,500 feet, or a mile and a half, or 5 miles when they say...
Oh, how close?
Yeah, because there's, I've learned like, oh, it's right next to it can mean a lot of different things.
Well, with geological faults, like a lot of the effects you'd expect would be widespread over, say, a mile.
Yeah,
so,
sure. Okay.
So maybe here it's like within a mile of the temple,
there's
the
this.
Two faults intersect. Like, I don't know if there's actually an X on the ground.
That does seem significant.
Right, and that would affect. And what's more, like, so these guys co-author a paper based on this new information, and what they find is that everybody was wrong for centuries. There was a chasm.
What?
The oracle was up on a tripod above a fissure that was spewing fumes.
So for centuries, they thought it was some kind of metaphor or it was just a fake.
Yeah, like there was a Greek myth about a magic spring, and there was never anything there. And not until 1996 did these guys prove that there actually is a fault line there, so slippage is happening. And what happens is then that generates heat, that friction generates heat. It was well understood that the rock here was kind of bituminous limestone. So it's limestone that contains some coal, oils and petrochemicals.
Right.
And so when heat hits something volatile like that, whatever the lighter stuff is, it evanesces. So gases would get released from this kind of rock if it got hot enough. And what's more, we have descriptions from Plutarch of what the, two things. One, what the smell was. He describes the pneuma, The fumes arising from the fissure are smelling like expensive perfume.
Oh, so not sulfuric.
Right. So we have an account of what it might be. And I think that's why people were like, look, there's no volcano here. It's right. It's not sulfur. This is nothing. This is made up. He also says there were two different types of trance. Like when the Oracle first sniffed the Pneuma, she would kind of go into a relaxed, suggestible state.
Sweet.
But later, if the Oracle, if the Pythia got too much of the Pneuma, she would actually get frantic and crazy.
Bummer.
And yeah. Well, I think we've all been there. So this is what DeBoer and Hale say. Like, this is exactly what you would expect of somebody huffing hydrocarbons.
Oh, like, right.
At first, you'd be like, this is all, you know, everything is awesome. Let me tell you about your future.
Right.
And But too much of it, like, starts to mess with your head. And then you go through more oracles that way. So, like, there's also... I guess ethylene gas had been considered as an anesthetic throughout the 19th century because it had nitrous oxide-like effects, but it was much more powerful and intoxicant. So apparently, all the signs were there.
Wow.
The ethylene gas was getting released from the rocks here, and that was what led to this strange mantic state that the Greeks interpreted as communing with Apollo. And nobody knew until, like, this paper comes out in 1996.
Now, did it change based on geothermic or just sort of tectonic? Sometimes it was hot and sometimes it was not?
That's exactly what happened. So at the time of Plutarch's writing, he says, you know, since I've been the head priest, you know, we hear these stories about when the pneuma were really good. We're in a different time. You know, we don't have that. We just have the occasional bursts. You know, we have to make do with just regular wise fill-in women because the Oracle rarely gets enough of a huff to do any good.
Mm-hmm.
So even back then, it was kind of a lost golden age of the Oracle when the prophecies were really good.
Yeah.
And in fact, all the accounts of people going there for weighty political advice, the Oracle stopped dabbling in public affairs around the 5th or 4th century BC. And from then on, it was like kind of the way... modern religious authority is now like, well, we're not going to go to the Pope before we make war, but
right.
You still have your own little fiefdom where you can make religious pronouncements. And that's kind of what the Oracle had come to in Plutarch's day. You know, people would still come there for festivals, to make sacrifices, you know, to ask maybe theological questions.
But none of these wood wall answers.
Yeah, nobody was going to figure out how to beat the Persians. Nobody was going for video game advice. And it turns out that might coincide with the Oracle getting less good, you know, because there was less and less ethylene that was fueling the fervor.
A lot of ancient earthquakes in that area. I wonder if in recent times, and by that I mean the last 2,000 years, if there have ever been resurgences, even after the temple. I think probably if the temple was in ruins and you were just herding your goats through there after an earthquake and you were like, whoa, you might be like, no, the temple's back.
You'd probably come back. You'd be like, hey, we're going to go back up there tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's good pneuma. I think what happened is the fissure got covered. I don't know if it's an earthquake or if it's later construction or earth movement or whatever.
Oh, because they could not see it, and so they denied it existed.
Yeah, for thousands of years it was like, well, geologists know that this was just a story. But it turns out the ancients were right.
Well, thank goodness for some Dutch geologists. Just you know, we don't credit them enough.
Yeah, when everybody is skeptical about the UN.
Right.
Hey, if not for that UN surveyor, we wouldn't know that ethylene gas powered the invasion of, or the Battle of Salamis. Or
right, and all that Greek myth gets confirmed. Like, it could have been Apollo the whole time.
It turns out Apollo was real, and we just needed the United Nations to tell us.
We stopped believing in Apollo, and Apollo stopped moving the Earth.
But he never stopped believing in us.
And that concludes The Oracle of Delphi, entry 872.1S0911, which is a joke.
In your town?
Certificate number 25192 in the omnibus. Futurelings, social media apparently did exist in ancient times in the form of shrouded oracles.
In the form of priests pumping you for information.
That's right. But it barely exists even now and will have long ago died an inglorious death in your era. But if by happenstance some Dutch geologist, who will almost certainly be an octopus, discovers that Omnibus was real in whatever, 5096.
You think they'd have better evidence of us?
Well, yeah, but I mean, the platinum records will be buried here under our bunker. And how long before an octopus is up
who
here?
Who knows when somebody gets into those?
But there certainly will be a United Nations. But you can find us at Omnibus Project, at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick. If you go over to my Facebook page, say hi for me. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can hang out and chat with other futurelings wherever you are directed when you Google futurelings. Almost certainly it will not direct you to the United Nations. It will direct you to the web.
I don't know if I've ever been to the United Nations website.
I bet it's UN.org.
Do you think they have a cool blog?
UN.gov? Which do you think it is? UN.org? Or is it an org or is it a gov?
They're the world gov. They're an org, yeah, I bet.
I bet they are. You can mail us actual male things and female things and non-binary things to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155 or 98133.
Unclear. Don't try 44. It's a little dicey.
Do you have some mail over there? It looks like you do.
Yeah, Ben sent us stuff. Do you know this roadside attraction in Arizona, The Thing?
Oh, I sure do.
Here's a lenticular postcard to remind you of your visit.
We drove past The Thing over and over and over, and eventually I was like, what is The Thing?
That's what they want you to think.
And we pulled over, and then a couple of the guys got out of the van, and they went to see The Thing. And I think at that point, I stayed in the van because I was doing some interview with the Tucson alternative paper. And they came out, and I was like, how is The Thing? And they said, ugh, don't go in. It's not worth it. And so I personally have never seen The Thing.
Bet you were so close.
I was right there.
You were like outside the Oracle's inner sanctum.
Yeah.
Well, Ben says it's a museum of curiosities that he liked as a kid. It's how he imagines your house.
Oh, I don't think there's like a shriveled lizard boy in my house, yeah, which I think is the thing.
Do you have a basalope around here somewhere?
No, I did visit the Corn Palace, and the Corn Palace, don't bother, it's super boring, but it is kind of more like my house, the Corn Palace, than probably The Thing.
Ben recently visited this year. Some of the curiosities remain, but Hitler's car is now Churchill's car.
Oh, is it the same car?
Yeah, what are the odds? What are the odds that they shared a car? I guess they used to carpool, I guess.
You know what this house is like? It's like Wall Drug.
A little bit.
Yeah. It's like a smaller Wall Drug.
They also have a very large, nice, modern museum dedicated to the idea that aliens have colonized Earth from the Mesozoic era until the present.
Can confirm.
Is this actually run by crackpots and not just run by...
Carnies,
yeah. Because when you put up a big museum about aliens, it almost seems like you believe in it.
When you go down to the desert Southwest, there's lots of alien tourist stuff.
Sure.
And it normally doesn't, it's not just everywhere, but it kind of is now, increasingly, because I think the Roswell City Council started really churning up the bucks when they put a billboard out.
Everybody else got jealous.
Yeah, and they were like, hey, we see aliens too. So
they could come here.
It's a whole cottage industry.
Why would they only go to Roswell? The Center for Land Use Interpretation sent us a fun postcard of a sign saying, caution, scenic overlook. And there's also an ask for donations. I guess this is their end of year mailing list thing from our friends at the Center for Land Use Interpretation. And John from North Dakota, no wait, John from now in Florence, thanks us for not making fun of North Dakota anymore. Do we not?
When you say Florence, do you mean Firenze or do you mean...
Sorry, Florence, Massachusetts.
Florence, Massachusetts. Well, you know, I have been continually amazed at the fact that people do take it seriously when we make fun of places. And I got a letter the other day from somebody that said, why is Ken so racist against Australia?
Oh, just because they're awful. And their skulls are the wrong shape, so you can tell they don't have all the faculties that we do.
I said,
if that's racism, fine.
I said, for sure, Ken is not racist about the Aboriginal population of Australia. So what you mean is he's racist against the white people of Australia? Because I don't know if that passes the bar. I said, you know, we used to make fun of everyone. Ken is old enough to remember a time when we took the piss out of everyone and everything. And he still has that gene. He still has the desire. But, to make fun of everyone.
But I'm well aware of which areas are off limits.
And these days,
Australia is not one of them.
That's right. These days, the only places you can make fun of are Germany, Denmark, Canada, and Australia. And so Ken has all of this pent-up energy, and he's going to direct it at you.
That's funny that you're getting the Ken's a bad ally emails.
I think that people recognize that I'm just a real...
You're a friend to all the Australians.
Well, that. I am an ally to all people. But also, like, if you're going to criticize me, you have to start, like, way further up the chain. There's a lot more bad about me than you. So people are like...
Also, I can't really do it anymore because...
Because why?
Well, the host of Jeopardy is like kind of the property of the nation.
Right.
I'm the Oracle of Delphi.
You're gonna get an Australian candidate who's like, I won't do the show.
I made a joke on Twitter one time about that's what he would say. Yeah. Just like that. I made a joke on Twitter once about how I think I told you this. The funny thing about the Grapes of Wrath is that the happy ending in the movie is that they wind up in Fresno.
Mm-hmm.
This is a pretty
good one.
It's an innocuous joke.
I like it.
But not to whatever the Fresno TV affiliate is, who is like, we need to interview Ken about his anti-Fresno sentiments.
Yeah,
and I'm like, have you been there? It's really?
Well, you remember at your Christmas party not that long ago, I was talking to George Meyer, formerly of The Simpsons, and he was talking about his musical that he's working on.
Mm.
This is all harkening back to an earlier episode. And I said, well, you know, when it debuts on Broadway or... in Davis, California. And George, having been a comedy writer for a long time, was like, nice. And I said, what? And he was like, Davis. Like, you could have said Cleveland.
Good choice.
You could have said Fresno. But Davis, that just gets me. It just, like, right under the ribs.
Well, let's reassure John that we do still hate everything about North Dakota, right?
Well, you know, I always said that North Dakota should actually be the big sky state instead of Montana, because there are places where the sky is big in Montana, but there are also places where it's a smaller sky.
Plus, they're the Peace Garden state, which is like, if that's your best attraction...
I don't think it is, but I feel like North Dakota deserves to say, like, actually, we're the big sky
state.
They're
proud of their peaceful relations with Canada.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing about that is that the part of Canada that touches North Dakota has nothing in it
except antelopes. It's very easy to be peaceful with them.
Yeah.
It's harder for us up in Blaine. You know, we have to be peaceful with actual Vancouver suburbanites.
They're right over the border. Or except for there's that swampy...
That you have to drive through.
Part. Yeah, that's not really Vancouver.
He enjoyed... Oh, maybe we'll save this for... we should save this for an omnibus, an addenda. He has a follow-up about... From the whistling entry, his stepdaughter Rebecca is very good at mental math related to the Fermi equations.
Okay.
And he's run in that James Earl Ray ultra marathon.
Oh. Does he know the quadratic equation?
John, if you're listening, please let us know if you know the quadratic
equation. Don't look it up.
Nope.
If you know it, you know it.
And if you put a negative sign or a squared in the wrong place, that doesn't count.
That's right.
You can't be close with the quadratic equation.
Nope.
You got to be right on the money.
Is it less than or equal than? Less than or equal to? Or is it more than and equal to?
Is it plus or minus plus? He also sent us clippings about, historic travel destinations in North Dakota. We should visit both Williston and Dickinson, according to this ad from the North Dakota Tourist Council.
Mm-hmm. They're a little bit off the road.
With big pictures of bee photos on the back. And then here on the ad, he puts, the bee photos are by Sam Droge. I guess he felt bad because he cut off the photo credit.
Mm.
And he wants us to know who took this bee photo.
You know what? He's a good man.
Thank you so much, John.
Credit the photographer.
Thank you so much. We'll probably use your whistling notes on the next addenda show.
Let me just add, Ken, that I believe that everyone in North Dakota and Australia and Denmark and Germany...
They're all God's children.
They should subscribe to our Patreon.
Oh, yeah. Because they're all God's children.
They're all God's children. And also, if they want to improve relations between Ken and their great nations.
Here's why I'm skeptical of Australia. Y'all don't give to the Patreon.
A lot of people in Australia don't currently give to
the
our
vast
Patreon.
Majority of them do not.
And I think if more people, if Ken saw more people from Australia giving $5 a month to our Patreon,
it would really warm my heart.
He really might warm up, and that would make my life easier because people would stop mailing me about your anti-white Australian racism.
If you think I hate Australians, please tell me about it. Don't tell John.
Write to
which of us cares less?
OmnibusProject@gmail.com.
They can't write. They can't read and write.
Oh, you turned
See?
It.
I'm never going to give up. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, though, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But on the brighter side, the silver lining, if Providence allows, if Apollo allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.